I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 6th of January. Our guest this hour says there is a critical need for academics and policymakers to better understand the puzzle of how and why some immigrants become radicalized. In the last 15 years, more Islamic militants have emerged from Western countries. Terrorist organizations based in the Middle East are recruiting Muslims, she says, in the U.S. and Europe via social media. And we know little about the factors that would drive Muslim immigrants in a Western country to heed this call and become radicalized even at the cost of their own lives. So she and researchers with her surveyed 198 Muslims in the U.S., carefully chosen, we'll hear how in just a moment, about their cultural identities and attitudes toward extremism. And they found that there is evidence that religion is not the primary motivator for joining a radical movement like the Islamic State. Our guest is Sarah Lyons Pudia, a research scientist at Stanford University's Center for Social Psychological Answers to Real World Questions. She has examined intercultural conflict and motivations behind terrorism. Her research on the marginalization and radicalization risk among Muslim immigrants is in the Behavior Science and Policy Journal, and her article, A Warmer Embrace of Muslims Could Stop Homegrown Terrorism, appeared in The Conversation and was picked up by The Washington Post. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Sarah. Our phone number, as it always is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Sarah, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Tell me first about how you put together this study. You found 198 Muslims in the U.S. You've also done work in Germany, I know, asking about cultural identities and attitudes toward extremism, but you were very careful in how you picked people.
Yes, exactly. So when I was developing this research question to answer the puzzling question of why would someone want to aggress against the country that they live in, we needed to work with a trusted organization to study a population that is, you know, on a very sensitive topic. You can't just round up a group of Muslims and ask them, how much do you support terrorism?
Right.
That would be absurd.
Mm-hmm.
So we partnered with an organization called the World Organization for Resource Development and Education, who all from here on out call WORD. They're a nonprofit organization that works between the Muslim community, the larger American community, the government, to provide a better understanding of Muslim cultural issues. They're also very concerned with eradicating radicalism within the Muslim community. And so they have a trusted relationship with Muslims throughout the country. They're based in the D.C. area, but they work throughout the whole country. So we worked with them to first interview first and second generation Muslims in the U.S. And when I say first and second generation, I mean first generation immigrants, people who've moved to the U.S., and second generation refers to people who were born in the U.S., but their parents were immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
So we first talked to them and asked, you know, what are the issues facing Muslims in the American society? What sort of identity conflict issues do you face? How much do you feel like you're an American? How much do you feel like you belong to your heritage culture, whether that be of Pakistani origin or Turkish origin or so on? And from there on out, from these interview responses, which were with 20 people, we got a better sense of people's experiences and issues that they're facing. And so from that point, we developed a survey, which WORD helped us distribute online. And so we were targeting people on the young end of the spectrum, so from about 18 to 35, making it clear that our interest was really in understanding what sorts of experiences Muslims have had in American society and also to some extent their opinions about radicalism.
One of the major findings you found, and a lot of people will think, really? Is this so that there is evidence you've found that religion is not the primary motivator for joining a radical movement like the Islamic State? I think most people would think that it was religion, but it's not.
Right. Well, it's not that religion is an absent factor, and I didn't look at this particularly in my research, but other work has found and suggested that there are a lot of reasons within a person or due to their social circumstances that make radical organizations like ISIS more attractive to them. And the ideology that they pick up is one that's grounded in religion. But it's not actually that extremely religious people are the ones who are joining ISIS. And in fact, there are several specific examples of people who didn't really know much about Islam at all. There were, I believe, convicted terrorists in Great Britain who had ordered Islam for Dummies before going to fight in Syria. And so it's not necessarily the more religious people who are turning to extremism, but people who actually don't know very much about the religion or are looking to grow a stronger identity with the Muslim community.
Many of the people on a quest for significance, and let's talk about what significance is, a sense that their lives have purpose and meaning, they have lost a sense of significance?
Right. So everyone, and we're not just talking about Muslim Americans, but every single human being wants to feel like they matter.
Sure.
Like they're living for a sense of purpose. They have some meaning in their life. And people derive that sense of meaning in a lot of different ways. And one key way that people gain a sense of meaning in their lives is by belonging to groups. Groups of people who tell them that they're important and they believe in them and their lives matter. And so there's been some theorizing in academic circles that a lot of people who join radical movements are actually looking for a chance to feel like they matter, like they're significant. And radical groups know and exploit this. They tell their potential recruits, if you join us, you'll be doing something for the larger Muslim community. You're going to, you know, fight against people who have treated us poorly. Your work for our organization will be rewarded in the afterlife. And so this can be really powerful for someone who's lacking that sense of purpose already.
You also compare it in some ways, and I'm wondering if you've done studies on this, that it's not unlike the sense of community that street gangs promise to American young people who lack a feeling of belonging and direction in their lives.
Right. That's another example of how this need for belongingness, for groups to afford you a sense of purpose, is not in any sense limited to Muslim Americans or to cultural minorities. I specifically, in my research, looked at how people's relationship within their cultural communities might relate to one's sense of purpose. But indeed, it can. This affects everyone.
And the people who you found were most attracted to radical causes identified, they didn't identify with their heritage culture, and they also didn't identify with their culture that they're living in currently. So they have no identification.
Exactly. So like I said, one way that people gain a sense of purpose in their life is by belonging to groups. And that can include a lot of different kinds of groups, our friends, our colleagues, other our religious organizations. And the sense that we belong to our culture, our nationality, our society is also very important. And for immigrants, this is a really unique situation because they're dealing with a cultural balancing act. So say you were born in the U.S., but your parents were Pakistani immigrants. You feel a desire to connect to American culture, pop culture, your classmates in school, but you also have grown up with some influence from your parents' heritage. And trying to reconcile, well, how much do I feel like I'm an American, or how much do I feel like I'm Pakistani, can be a really tough balancing act. And the research has shown that people really do best when they can have a little bit of both. And when people have neither, they don't fare so well.
Mm-hmm. And when you're holding on in some ways to your heritage culture, you also want to be able to not be reprimanded, as people have done in France, if you're wearing a certain kind of clothing, if you're espousing your religious beliefs in a certain way, that some are saying you can't do this and have banned, say, the wearing of the burqa in France.
Exactly. So one problem is that some societies, you know, to greater extent than others, push the idea that if you're living in this country, you have to adapt all of the customs and values that we practice here, leaving little room for people to continue to practice and value their own cultural customs.
How about the element, though, of joining a cause which may give your life purpose and meaning, but also you have to be willing to give up your life?
Right. That's a really fascinating problem. It's hard to imagine that anything would be worth possibly giving up your life. But there has been a lot of work on the psychology of martyrdom, on when people are looking for meaning, that goal to gain meaning can actually trump your desire to survive. It's a puzzling phenomenon, but one that is very real.
Mm-hmm. And so that may be turn out to be hard to believe, but it may be one of the reasons that it's an attraction for some people who feel so marginalized that here's something I can be willing to die for?
Mm-hmm. That might be one reason.
You talk about the opposite of lives that have purpose and meaning, personal trauma, shame, humiliation, and perceived maltreatment by society. Let's center on the last one for a moment. Did you get a lot of responses of maltreatment in society, and what kinds of maltreatment were specified?
Right. So I was looking in particular at people's experiences of having been discriminated against. And I'll say, you know, there's a lot of discussion in the media right now about Islamophobia, maltreatment of Muslims in the United States. And first, I do want to point out that the majority of people who participated in my study did actually say that they felt like they were able to practice their religion in the United States. So it's not that every single person has experienced some
right.
form of maltreatment. But it's very real now, especially in the past couple of months in the wake of the Paris attacks and also in San Bernardino. And so these are the sorts of experiences. I mean, just think about it yourself. If you are being told that your religion is wrong or inherently violent and you're not wanted here, you start to think about how this reflects on you personally. And that can really have a negative bearing on your own sense of purpose and self-worth.
Anti-immigrant discourse likely to fuel support for extremism rather than squelch it?
Well, that's exactly the paradox that I'm talking about here, is that, you know, following the attacks, policymakers, public officials are obviously very concerned with protecting, you know, our homeland against terrorist threats. And some have said that this may involve excluding Muslims from entering the U.S. or monitoring Muslims on American soil. And this is all thought to be in the interest of providing protection, right? But the paradox is that it might actually end up causing these sorts of threats to personal significance that end up thrusting people toward radical groups. So that's not what we want either.
Mm-hmm. You say that one of the reasons, one of the ways we need to decrease homegrown radicalization, we want to improve integration of Muslim immigrants, welcoming Syrian refugees, not excluding them, redefining what it means to be American, and I know you've studied this in Germany as well, in a way that is inclusive and doesn't represent only the majority culture. Do you think we do have a majority culture in this country?
Oh, gosh, it's so complicated because the United States in particular is a nation of immigrants. And so who we are today has very much been shaped by the contributions of different cultures. I think that when people talk about majority culture, they're often referring to, you know, European cultural influences. But what it means to be American, what it means to be a part of American culture is always changing. And so, you know, we in American society right now see a version of American culture that we've always grown up with and are very accustomed to. But what's important to remember is that this is always changing. And we shouldn't, you know, make very clear delineations of what is American culture and what isn't, and this doesn't include things that other cultures from the Middle East, for example, want to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm. So tell me more what you think we should be doing to improve integration of Muslim immigrants.
I think it's a very complicated question, and I certainly have a simple answer. But one place to start is not expecting or asking immigrants, and I'm not just talking about Muslim immigrants, I'm talking about immigrants in general, not asking them to completely leave their own culture at the door when they come to the U.S., because that can lead to resentment. This was something that we saw a little bit in Germany. So, for example, immigrants in Germany are supposed to take integration courses when they arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And these integration courses are actually kind of tutorials on how to be German. But there needs to be more about how to learn important aspects of German culture or American culture, certainly language acquisition. But what it means, how you can be an American while also being someone who comes from your own heritage country. On Americans' end, it involves having a genuine interest in other cultures. Something we noticed when we did our initial interviews is that people would say, you know, Americans really pride themselves on being a multicultural society, and we feel very proud that we have people from so many different cultures here and so much, you know, multicultural influence. But when you get into the thick of it, Americans aren't always extremely interested in developing a deeper, more genuine understanding of different people's cultural backgrounds. And so I think that's one part of it, is to really express an interest in learning more about people's backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you have this really strong movement politically led by Donald Trump these days that's saying exactly the opposite of what you're talking about. I wonder if you worry about that.
I am worried about that, as a matter of fact. I think when you're coming from the majority culture angle, it's easy to not necessarily understand the concerns on the other side. Someone like myself, for example, I was born in the U.S. My parents were not immigrants, nor were my grandparents. I personally don't have much experience trying to balance cultures. I pretty much consider myself American. But that's not the case for a lot of people who do have much more recent experience balancing cultural identities. And, you know, the research shows that people do best when they're able to balance both cultural identities. If we want a society with people who are doing well, we will benefit from encouraging people to balance their cultural identities more so than we will forcing them to just adopt all of our values and practices.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Sarah, and we'll do that in just a moment. Sarah Lyons Padilla is our guest. She's a research scientist at Stanford University's Social Psychological Answers to Real World Questions Institute, and she focuses on intercultural conflict, motivations behind terrorism. Her research on the marginalization and radicalization risk among Muslim immigrants is in the Behavior Science and Policy Journal, and her article, A Warmer Embrace of Muslims Could Stop Homegrown Terrorism, appeared in the Washington Post. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. She did a survey, and there aren't many of these having been done, of Muslims in the U.S. about their cultural identities and their attitudes toward extremism, and found that those, and this wasn't a large number, but did find that those who identify neither with their heritage culture or the culture they're living in feel marginalized and less significant. Experiences of discrimination make the situation worse and lead to greater support for radicalism. We'll ask what you think in just a moment. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming phone calls now, 800-486-8655 is our number. And we go to George in La Crosse for our first caller, Sarah. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good. I wondered if your guest has read the Quran or has read the Hadith or the Sunnah, because for those of us that have, it's very clear why people become jihadists who believe in the ideology of Islam. And the reason for that is that, number one, jihad is encouraged, and number two, if you die a martyr in Islam, it's a guarantee to paradise. There's no other way in the ideology of Islam that guarantees you paradise other than to become a martyr. So has your guest read any of this material?
Sarah.
Hi, so I'm not a religious scholar, so I won't claim to be an expert in Islam or any other religion for that matter. And I hear your question. It's a question I've heard before, and it's an important one to address. What meaning do we take from religious scriptures that seem to support this sort of extremism? Other points of view are that it's important to take religious scriptures into context, particularly in the modern context within which we live. A report came out from the Pew Research Center today estimating that there are currently 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, or at least there were in 2010, and so that number has since grown. About 23% of the global population is Muslim, and yet a very, very, very small percentage of them subscribe to this radical ideology that ISIS supports. And so I would just say that it's possible, indeed, to interpret the Quran as well as other religious scriptures in a way that promotes violence. But it's also important to realize that the majority of people who subscribe to the religion do not.
Why is it that these Islamist extremists target first and second generation people? Why that?
Well, that's a good question. I can't speak too much on what motivates ISIS's strategy, but it certainly helps them to have support in the West, you know, outside of just Syria and Iraq. And there are a lot of Muslims in the United States. Currently, that number is about, I had it, but I don't have it anymore in front of me.
You say it's 5 to 12 million Muslims live in the U.S.
Oh, good. You have my paper.
I do, yeah.
Right. Right. So certainly there's the potential for them to develop a supporter base there. And they, you know, prey on people who, you know, with the arguments that they're the American society and the West doesn't support Muslims, and look how you've been treated. And so, you know, they prey on the sort of anti-Islamic discourse that happens in this country.
Let's go to Bill next in Mauston. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good.
I just wanted to comment on the, when you were talking about the integration, how Germany has set up integration classes and stuff like that. and that people in the country need to be a little bit more sympathetic towards the cultures of the other people. Well, when I go back to, of course, I wasn't here when they migrated, but when my great-grandparents came here, I watched as it filtered down, but they came here to be Americans. They didn't come here from their respective countries to set up shop as a miniature country of origin within America. I mean, they went to the extent of Americanizing their names, but yet they still maintained their culture, but that was done in the home. It wasn't forced on everybody else. As they grew to know other people, they shared in some of the cultural aspects, but, you know, the whole idea is you migrate to a country to become part of that country.
Well, but on the other hand, Bill, there were enclaves. You look at the city of Milwaukee, there were Italian enclaves and German enclaves and Irish enclaves. It took a long time for people to sort of move out of their own neighborhoods.
By third generation, though, I mean, it was, you're already looking at everybody splitting up, and the Italians were marrying the Germans and Irish marrying the Polish, and, you know, the whole thing got up. But, you know, they didn't, they stuck together as the immigration base, but then as their kids grew up, they filtered, and they encouraged their children to become American. They spoke their language, but they said, you speak that in the house. When you go outside, you speak English.
So you're saying that...
I remember specifically my great-grandmother saying that to my mother.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that Muslims are not doing that?
I'm sorry?
Are you saying that Muslims are not doing that? They're not integrating?
You know, I would have to say that if you go and look into third-generation Muslims, you're probably going to find that they've assimilated quite the same as other immigrant cultures. You're talking more about your first generation and being more problematic towards joining up with these groups and stuff like that. But if you go down the line, if you've got, doesn't matter what culture it is, Muslim or whatever their background is, by third generation, they're pretty filtered out.
Mm-hmm. Sarah?
Yeah, so you make a really interesting point. And when you talk about cultural enclaves, you're talking about another group of people who acculturate in a sort of different way, which is to say, I'm really going to hold on to my heritage culture and not engage so much with the larger society. And the research has found that that's not really the most adaptive strategy either. But what I do want to point out from my own data is that, while I'm focusing here, at least in my paper, my article, on what happens for people who feel culturally homeless, what shouldn't be overlooked is that the majority of people who I surveyed actually said they did really want to integrate aspects of their American identity and their heritage cultural identity into their daily life. And so that might involve speaking your language at home and going out and speaking English and being active in your local mosque and also having a social circle that includes people from different religious backgrounds. And so I think that by and large, Muslim Americans are interested in having a life that includes important elements of both cultures.
Thanks very much for your call, Bill. Richard wanted to know if you know how many Muslims in the U.S. are Shia versus Sunni, if they get along here in the United States, and if you were able, I'll ask this too, in your surveys to delineate between those groups when it came to answers to your survey.
That's a good question. So again, being that I'm not a religious scholar, I can't really speak to great length on these demographic patterns in the U.S. We did ask in our survey for people to note which sect of Islam that they belong to, and so I can certainly look at that in my data, but I actually haven't so far.
Mm-hmm. There was also, you just mentioned this, and I thought this would be an interesting show. I believe it was Denmark. You wrote in your either the newspaper article or in the long paper that you did, Denmark, that was taking in former jihadis to try to integrate them again in Danish society. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's so interesting. And again, I don't know too many details about this program, but the gist of it is that it's a partnership between the Muslim community and, I think, local law enforcement. So they're looking for ways, rather than, you know, the issue of returning foreign fighters is terrifying. The idea that people have become trained abroad and might come back equipped to carry out attacks on your own soil, mm-hmm. what do you do with that? Mm-hmm. And so the approach they've taken is that if we cooperate, if the local law enforcement cooperates with the Muslim community, and we identify these people and we sit them down and we say, listen, we want to give you a chance to live a productive life in Danish society. How can we, you know, reconcile the beliefs you have, the injustices you feel like you've experienced, you know, what you find important in your own religious and cultural upbringing, and how can we make this all work as a member of Danish society?
Let's go to Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I really appreciate your guest comments. I mean, it goes back to what I said a long time ago, but back to the philosopher David Hume, that the good regard of self and the good regard of others affects our behavior. My comment is, and I think Donald Trump is the classic example, and maybe one of our earlier callers about Islam, is that we live in a society where people listen to their own reality. They listen to their own cable news network. They listen to their own internet blogs, and they are not penetrated by objective facts any longer. For example, when we lived in the days of Huntley and Brinkley and Walter Cronkite, and I'll take my response or your guest comments off to the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Do you want me to comment?
Please, Sarah.
Yeah, so thank you for your comments. I appreciate that. I think, you know, you're pretty on point that people, and this is a psychological phenomenon, listen to information that confirms what they think. And both, you know, sides politically are guilty of that. One thing that's been really interesting, an interesting outcome of writing this article is that, you know, I've had the opportunity to hear a lot of people's varying perspectives.
And, I'm sure you have.
Yeah, and so as we move forward, it's important to take into account the very real concerns that people have on all sides and incorporating these into the solutions we develop.
Thank you very much for the call. Facebook comment from Jeff. I agree with your guest. Treat people well and the likelihood of radicalization of any group decreases. Basic sociology, is it?
It's, you know, yes. when people feel like they're treated well, they're going to feel better about themselves and the groups that they belong to, and are certainly less likely to find appeal in organizations that are promoting harm against others. And that applies to terrorist organizations as well as, you know, other groups that may cause harm.
Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I want your guest's response to my assertion that certain forms of religious expression, I'm thinking of certain subsects of Jews or of Anabaptists in the United States of America, the most familiar to most Americans being the Amish, as setting themselves apart as a society, never really do integrate into American society. There's a sort of arm's length tolerance for one another. I know we're talking globally in the sense of Islam as a religion, when of course it is like Christianity, many, many religions, many, many interpretations of Islam exist, but people who insist on dressing as though they're setting themselves apart from the society in which they want to function fully, and I think the French have wrestled with this. I know the Danes have. I lived in Denmark briefly. It's not unusual for the mainstream culture to ask, what are you doing here, and what are we supposed to be, how are we supposed to be responding to you? Because you seem to say our values are at odds with your values. Why would you choose to live here in this society? I hope that's not too harsh, but that just seems to be the reality of some religious expressions.
Sarah.
Sorry. Yeah. This is a question that I've heard asked quite often. I guess there are a couple of points to this comment. The first is why would you move to a country if you didn't want to adopt the customs there? And you know, it's complicated. There are a lot of reasons why people move to new countries. There are certainly, like right now, for example, there's the refugee situation. There are people who move for educational or professional reasons or economic reasons, and so people come for a lot of different reasons and to varying extents may or may not want to, you know, give up their cultural customs. But I don't think it's something that we should necessarily demand on our end. And, you know, the caller noted the issues faced in France, for example, with religious articles of clothing. Bans on certain, well, actually, I think the France ban is on all religious articles of clothing, which would include, I suppose, like a cross necklace or something like that, as well as, you know, headscarves or...
Oh, really?
The burqa ban. Well, I know it has something to do with in public settings. Like, I know in universities, for example, I better not speak too much on that because I don't want to say anything that's incorrect, but the point is that you've then decided for someone else whether or not they can express themselves culturally or religiously, which you know certainly has a potential for backlash.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rich, very much for your call. David in Madison. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, David.
My comment is I'm an adopted person, and so I'm an American-American, and I find this whole kind of conversation about assimilation kind of disingenuous from that standpoint, being that everybody that came here through the 1800s, 1900s from their home country still puts it first. People still refer to themselves that have been here for five generations as German-American, and then they'll practice their German heritage, and then they speak like German. They teach only German at, like, Wisconsin Heights High School, you know. So these type of things that now we have new immigrants coming and we're expecting them to do something that they don't do. We even go so far as when you don't have a country, we'll just assign your continent, and so we call black people now African Americans, you know. So that was just my comment.
We do a lot of that in this country, don't we? We celebrate our heritage. Do you think we go overboard with that, Sarah?
I'm not really in a position to say whether we go overboard or don't do enough. I think everyone's history, everyone's story about how they came to the United States is very different, and you know, our position as Americans towards incoming immigrants has, you know, always been sort of tailored to the particular immigrant wave that's coming in at a given point in history. So it's hard to really make generalizations. But you know, there were immigrant groups that came in the past couple of hundreds of years that are now considered to be very well integrated, but at the time experienced a lot of challenges. Mm-hmm. And so we're experiencing a different wave of immigrants now than we were in the past. And, you know, the situation a couple hundred years from now might be very different than it is today.
I'm thinking of the difference between the United States and Canada and how they have been welcoming Syrian refugees. Canada, very, very different than what we've been doing. We have this big debate and this political rhetoric that is very anti-Muslim. Is there a difference, do you think, in how easy it is to live in Canada if you've come here, if you're Muslim from another country? And does it result in fewer people becoming radicalized because they seem to be treated better?
Well, what I can say from Canada, being that my personal experience with Canada is limited to being on the Canada side of Niagara Falls, is that they sort of subscribe to a different sort of metaphor when it comes to immigrant acculturation. And so you're probably all familiar with the idea of the melting pot. That's something that we as Americans have promoted for some years, that everyone comes in from their different cultural backgrounds and kind of all melts together into this homogenous American society. In Canada, the metaphor that's been more popular is the cultural mosaic or the mixed salad. So here you also have all of these different ingredients coming into the equation, but rather than melting and becoming something homogenous, they're just an important ingredient in the overall recipe that's distinct but part of the whole dish. And I think the melting pot metaphor is starting to fall out of fashion in the United States as well, but it's just a sort of different approach in how we see people's cultural contributions and what they mean in a greater sense. And to address the overall question of are people's experiences different in the United States or Canada or other countries, for example, yes, very much so. And that's something that I am looking to address once I get more of a look at the data I've collected in Germany.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Sarah Lyons Padilla, and she is a research scientist at Stanford University's Social Psychological Answers to Real World Questions Center. She studies intercultural conflict and motivations behind terrorism. This is a very interesting study of 198 Muslims chosen carefully in the United States to find out how marginalized they were and how much marginalization may make them more interested in radicalization. And it's, well, it's more than that, the whole study, but that's in a nutshell what it's all about. Some interesting findings, and would lead her to believe, and the researchers she has worked with, that what we need to do instead of saying get out of here is do quite the opposite, and it would reduce the risk of homegrown terrorism. All right, more phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A couple Facebook comments. Adrian on Facebook writes, it's always good to be accepting of people in all cultures and to make an effort to understand who they are as well as their traditions. It's a mistake, she says, to discount the uneasiness of the people who understand that the attacks we endured were carried out by Muslim citizens of our country. Hearing from this group denouncing the attacks would have gone a long way in helping people assuage their fears, but I have no recollection of such public announcements from the Muslim community in the United States. I certainly heard people from the Muslim community denounce the attacks in San Bernardino, didn't you?
I did as well. You know, to acknowledge this this commenter's point, being accepting towards other people's cultural heritage and inviting them to express their own cultural heritage in the United States shouldn't mean that we aren't concerned about the very real threat that is homegrown radicalization or radicalization, you know, that's developed within the U.S. This is really outside of my domain of expertise as a social scientist, but it's interesting. I've heard this debate, which is we want to hear the Muslim community denounce right. acts of terrorism, and then there, and then within the Muslim community, why are we responsible for denouncing these horrible acts that we don't support at all? So it's a really tricky question. You know, what do we expect the Muslim community to do on their end, and how much condemnation do we want to hear? Yeah, it's an interesting point.
Mm-hmm. Joanne in West Dallas, hi.
Hi, Kathleen, thank you. I'm not sure even how to phrase this question, but I was just wondering how I, as an individual, what's the practical way to do something about the marginalization of Muslims as a Christian. I'm a follower of Jesus, and I don't know if, you know, if churches can have classes so that we can understand each other better, or if I were to go to an Islamic center, would I be welcome there just trying to befriend someone or trying to learn more about them so that I'm not afraid every time I see someone in a burqa or You know, how as an individual can we bridge the gap?
Thank you for that question. I'm so glad you asked because, you know, we've been talking about a topic that's really complex in a lot of ways abstract. We're talking about how to be open towards people from different cultural and religious backgrounds. But at the end of the day, you want to know how to do it, right? And I think some of the things that you mentioned are excellent ways to show that you, as an individual, are interested in learning more about other faiths outside your own. Just to give a short anecdote from where I come from a city in Virginia. So I'm in California now, but I'm a Virginian. And there was an episode in my county recently where there were some negative remarks made at a town meeting against the local Islamic center that wanted to approve plans for expanding a mosque. And that turned into a pretty horrible fiasco. And the Islamic Center, in response, held an open house and invited people from the community to come in and to ask questions about Islam and learn more about the religion and get to know people on an interpersonal level. And I guess probably part of that goal is to not be so fearful of a group that you don't know so much about. So I think that, you know, what you suggested, which is reaching out to other people of the Islamic faith is a great way to show that you're interested.
John, thank you so much, Joanne, for your call. John says, America is a nation of immigrants. Embracing culture as well as having acceptance and tolerance of different cultures is what makes America great. It certainly is what sets us apart from so many nations on earth, doesn't it, Sarah?
I think so. And, you know, I want to point out that we've been talking about a lot of really negative stuff about Islamophobia, exclusion, marginalizing people. But in my data and what I said at the very beginning, most people said they actually do feel like they're accepted here and are able to simultaneously feel American and practice their religion. And so we should actually focus on just continue doing that and more of it.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go back to the survey for a moment. Of those that you interviewed, was it a very small percentage of responses saying that they would be interested in a radical version of expressing support for an Islamic State? What were the percentages here?
Right. So it's difficult to frame in terms of percentages because the way we asked this question was kind of like, to what extent would you feel attracted to, and this was like a hypothetical group. So you, for obvious reasons, you can't ask people, you know, on a scale of 1 to 7, how much do you feel like joining ISIS? You know, that's just a crazy way to frame a question. No one's going to answer honestly, and many people probably haven't given it much thought. So what we did was we designed a hypothetical group that was based on previous work in psychology that sort of simulated aspects of radical organizations, and we asked people how much they liked this group and would maybe want to be a part of it or work on their behalf or understand if they engaged in some sort of extreme behavior, and, you know, how much. And these are sort of ranges, so a little bit, a lot, moderately. And so it's not like we have definitive yes or no responses, but on average, support for this group was very low.
Mm-hmm. One more quick phone call, almost at a time. Erilyn Madison, hi.
Hi. My first point is, for anyone wondering about extremism, I think Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, he's one of the scholars, he talks about both sides, these so-called Muslims that go extreme or the regular people that pick parts out of the Quran. He'll take those specific parts and talk about them, that it does nothing have to do with Quran. And second point, because we're short on time, I just want to say as a Muslim, I'm able to practice 100%. The Constitution allows, in the Quran, I'm allowed to do everything 100%. They're compatible. I don't see nothing, you know, contradicting each other.
Thank you very much, Errol, for your call. Well, Sarah, it was an interesting article. Let us know about your further research, and thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Certainly. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. And we want to make sure that you listen to our number two of our program. We're going to be talking about Wisconsin's heavily gerrymandered districts, and they are heavily gerrymandered. There are other states that are gerrymandered in an opposite way, and our guests this hour are working to change all of that and would like for the U.S. Supreme Court to take up this issue. How likely is that to happen? We will talk about that. Hour two of our program. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this hour, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We thank our guest for her research on how we need to have a warmer embrace of Muslims, and it could stop homegrown terrorism.